Testing. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Sound excited, right?
Yes.
All right. Let me turn up the mic. Better. So, thank you for coming. This is a panel called The Year of the Data Breach. So, as many of you have probably heard, there have been a lot of hacks in the last year or two. Recently, the federal government was hacked. And about almost 22 million people's personal information was taken, including their psychological profiles, their next door neighbors, family information. And it's not the first time. There have been multiple other hacks over the years. So we have a panel of experts here today who are going to tell you how to make it so you can never possibly be hacked. And myself. So, I'm just kind of down the road here.
Just don't go on that.
Hello. My name is Amy Stepanovich. I am the U.S. Policy Manager for a group called Access Now. We're a global organization that extends and defends the rights of users around the world. So amongst other things, we have a policy team that I'm a member of that advocates with governments and other policymakers to have rights respective laws put into place, both in the U.S. and the EU and Latin America and all of the other areas. We also have a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week tech team that operates all over the globe to help activists, journalists, people who are in danger try to overcome some of the technical hurdles that they face. My personal background, I come to Access from the Electronic Privacy Information Center, where I led their domestic surveillance project, working specifically on privacy and cybersecurity. A lot of work for on drones and drone surveillance, and now work on digital surveillance.
And my name is Blair Chantel. I'm an attorney. I practice in the Atlanta area primarily. I've handled a lot of cases involving technology and trying to explain technology to 90-year-old judges.
Hey everybody, my name is Chris Grayson. I am an Atlanta native. I am a penetration tester, so I simulate these real-world attacks on companies to help them find the holes that real-world attackers use and basically walk them through fixing those vulnerabilities. From Georgia Tech. Anybody else likes Georgia Tech here?
Hello. My name is Josh Root. Also an Atlanta native. I work here in the Atlanta area as a security analyst. I do a little freelance work on the side, a little penetration testing here and there. I've been working in this industry for professionally, probably the greater half of a decade. So the greater half of a decade I've been in this industry, but I've been doing this type of thing long enough to say that I submitted bugs when America Online was still a thing. So that's my background.
I'm Tim Farley. I'm a security analyst and software developer. I've worked for a number of the security product companies that were in the Atlanta area, like Internet, the former Internet Security Systems, and Spy Dynamics. So I've worked on building the tools that people use to detect hackers or to stop hackers. I've also taught classes on reverse engineering, so to take apart malware and figure out what this stuff is doing or trying to do in your system around the country and around the world. And now I am a security analyst for a major company that I can't mention because they don't want me to. And of course, anything I say here is my own personal opinion and not theirs. But I do, you know, the day-to-day security analyst and security work on a product that's used by thousands of business people. And so we're being attacked all the time. And so we kind of live the trying to defend ourselves against the data breach.
And just kind of by a show of hands, who here has heard of the Sony hack? How about the hack of Home Depot? About the recent one of the Office of Personnel Management. Has anyone been the victim of these? So you're obviously very familiar with these issues here. So basically, for those who don't know, the Sony hack was perpetrated by somebody or a group of people who call themselves the Guardians of Peace, I believe.
Closer.
The Guardians of Peace, I believe, are the group that perpetrated the hack against Sony, and their primary motivation was the release of the movie The Interview. Which basically, for those who don't know, showed the attempted assassination of North Korea's great omnipotent leader. And of course they didn't like that. If you know anything about North Korea, they're always blustering about nuking somebody. So that was apparently the primary motive for that hack, but there are hacks happening all the time. Across the country, across industries, and variety. It's almost unlimited, so I guess kind of the first question is, you know, why do these hacks keep happening?
I can lead off here. It's simple economics. I mean, you have supply and demand, and when there's a specific demand for something, the supply will rise to match it. And there's a significant demand for all of the illicit information that we see being released through these breaches. You know, social security numbers, credit card numbers, personally identifying information, healthcare information, all of this stuff is how you make money illicitly online. And you have organized crime groups that are making money through these means. So it's simple economics.
Yeah, I would echo that. I mean, there was a time, you know, a few decades ago, or the beginning of the internet era, when there was this image of the hacker being someone working in the basement, just fooling around and trying stuff out. And there are still folks out there who just try stuff out, figure stuff out, and do that kind of thing. But a lot of it has become an organized crime thing. It's a big business, and we saw that in a weird way in the malware reverse engineering business of, you know, when you get malware samples and you take them apart, you learn a lot about how those programs are put together. And the early malware and the early viruses were very kind of hand-coded, cobbled together. A lot of them had bugs. A lot of malware isn't nearly as powerful as it could be because it simply is poorly written code and crashes or doesn't do the right thing when it's supposed to. Now we're starting to see malware that literally shows evidence of a professional QA group having tested it, of having what's called unit tests, if you know software engineering, and those types of things. You see evidence of that in the code. So these people are very, very serious about what they do and turning it into a business. And there's business at every level of it. There are people who build the malware and sell it to the folks who want to steal the credit card numbers. And then there's the folks who steal the credit card numbers and sell them to other people. And then there's folks who do things with the credit card numbers and make money that way. So there's all sorts of, there's a whole economy to it. You know, wherever they can find troves of information that they can, as they say, monetize, they will go after it.
If anybody has questions, feel free to raise your hand if you'd like to.
They're also, I think they're happening far too often because of bad security practices and bad password management and bad training. It's not necessarily like the advanced persistent actor, the actor who's going after these threats because they have political motivation, something like The Interview, may get in eventually, but they're getting in far too easily, and we're making it very easy for them. And companies have these incentives to collect a lot of data. There's a lot of money in collecting data. There's a lot of money in retaining that data for a long period of time. And the problem is they're not thinking about data security up front, and they're not protecting it. They're not encrypting far too often. They're not encrypting. And so we're trying to get them to, as a policy matter, we have been trying to talk to these companies and tell them that they need to think about this way, way earlier than they are. A lot of small companies think that data can save the world and think that they're going to be the ones to do it. They're going to have the great idea that collects the information that saves the world. And they're putting it all into a database and making it very easy for these hackers and the attackers to get into those databases.
I have another question pursuant to that.
I guess pursuant to that question is primarily for Chris. So I'd like to know, first of all, you know, the question was posed, you know, why do these hacks happen? The first thing that pops into my mind is like, how is it possible? So I guess one possible way is you've got the old war games kind of model with Matthew Broderick, where he just kind of randomly dials a number, comes across like this phone number modem thing, and you know, just try to do all these different passwords or whatever, it comes with this like back door or whatever. But then there's like application exploits where you've got bad code or whatever through browsers or spoofed web pages or whatever that redirect like these or something like that. So the first question is, how do most of these hacks happen? How does an OPM server get hacked into? What are they jumping through? What are these hackers jumping through? Is it a phone number that you stumble upon? Is it some kind of, you know, web browser application that's written? You know, that's the first thing. And secondly, you know, how can it seem so easy just given the matter of time?
Well, here's the thing, it is so easy. And that's one of the disappointing things. That's one of the disappointing things, pursuant, yes, to what Amy said, is that it's not terribly difficult to get into a lot of places, especially if you look in the government sector, because you have constrained budgets, you have just, it's much more difficult to secure things given the high level bureaucracy and low level bureaucracy you see in that area. As far as how do these people get in, all of the above, every single one of those ways. Something like the OPM, I don't know if the initial attack vector was ever disclosed.
Not that I'm aware.
But it can be poorly written software, it can be a web application, it can be somebody brings an infected laptop onto your perimeter, it can be somebody breaks into your wireless network, it can be that, you know, it's breaking your own device, so somebody's phone is compromised. They exploit like open ports or something.
Not generally. A lot of what we see, anyway, is custom application. You know, the kind of the old days of there was this bug in this version of Windows that you could exploit, you know, every Windows box that had this version of Windows on it. Those kinds of things are hopefully starting to be a little bit less because people are better at patching. We have automated patching. Companies know they need to patch. So there's an awareness of that. But the problem is that it's gone on to the next level of what are you running on that Windows box or that web server? It's usually a custom app that you developed to run your company store or whatever. And are you keeping that patched, or are your developers aware of the types of ways that attackers will abuse a web app through SQL injections and things like that? But the biggest thing we see, because we kind of have our ducks in a row and test this stuff, and we know that we're staying on top of all of that. The biggest problem we see is social engineering and email-based attacks. So just wacky emails get sent in of, here's that receipt for that $200 thing you didn't think you ordered, and the person panics and says, wait a minute, what? I didn't order this, what does this receipt say? And they click on it and something horrible happens. We get a ton of that, and we have to, you know, be very, very, very careful about that kind of thing. To the point that our company actually sends fake stuff like that to our own employees, and if you click the link, it will send you to a training video.
Social engineering is absolutely one of the easiest ways that people get in. In the course of some penetration tests that I've been on, we've even been on engagements where we send out 120 emails, and after we compromise 70 people out of those 120, we get asked to very kindly, please stop, you're phoning us too much. That's on basically every company that you can go against as well. Not every single one, there are some exceptions, but absolutely, yes.
And I think a good thing to mention would be that when, you know, it's asked, you know, how do people get in, how do they figure out how to get in, the first step to ever getting into a system is doing your reconnaissance. And if anyone's familiar with the Stuxnet worm, it was a worm that was literally designed to attack a certain type of microcontroller and a power plant in another part of the world, and it was literally delivered through a USB payload over months and months and months. Someone just picked up a USB drive that happened to work this power plant, plug into a system, it wasn't hooked to this microcontroller. Went somewhere else, wasn't there. Went somewhere else, and it passed and passed and passed. And finally, someone popped it into a machine that had direct access to this microcontroller, and it caused all sorts of problems to that power plant.
That was the
Iranian power plant. And that it took months, but someone signed it for literally just that one purpose.
I just wanted to make a commentary on what you said. I mean, I actually work as a SIM engineer, so I know all this stuff that's going on. And I do agree with you that for a lot of corporations, there's not enough security awareness and training provided. But also, to tack on with what you said, a lot of it has to do with budget constraints. I mean, they don't want to sink the money into the security technology to help prevent it. What amazes me is how they actually, especially with the payment card, how they can actually get through PCI DSS and get through any type of audits. I mean, it's just amazing to me.
It's more like guidelines.
Well, I know it's a guideline, but,
PCI is the standard that the credit card companies, in theory, make you follow so that you have at least a certain level of security in your systems before they will allow you to process credit cards.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to say names, but where I'm currently working, I mean, they do have a PCI subnetwork, and currently, you know, the PCI guidelines that you're supposed to have monitoring of everything falls within the scope. Well, three of the subsets of that subnet work in complete autonomy in this theater. Even though the endpoint and the database is encrypted, we don't have to worry about monitoring that information. And I'm like, yeah, let's just go ahead and let you take data be taken, and we'll come back in about 2 months when your bosses come to you and go, oh, you decided not to do that, you're fired. But yeah, I totally agree with you. I just, not people pay attention, and it's a big problem because you're putting that data into somebody else's hands for them to take care of, and they just seem like they want to ignore it for, you know, money and funds. So
to take a step back for a second, how many of you done something either on the internet or through text message? And thought, it's okay, I can do it this one. Like, nobody's gonna catch me doing this thing this one time. Like, I can get away with it. Has anybody? No? Maybe? So companies think that too, and it's a huge problem. We aren't going to get hacked. We aren't going to be attacked. And this is the problem. They don't want to invest in security up front because they see the chance that they actually get attacked in that way, in the way that Sony got it totally owned. So it's such a slim opportunity, or such a slim threat, that they won't put the money in because they think it'll be easier to not do it. And that's a problem not only at the corporate level, but at a government level. We just recently fought back a bill that would have stripped the government agency that is responsible for securing government networks to a budget pre-2014. So not only not raising it to what they are trying to do so they can adequately protect networks, but stripping it much further back, while at the same time raising the budget of the FBI unit that hacks into other people's computers and makes them less secure. So we had to go in and say, you know, you're not, look at OPM, you're not adequately funding government security, and you're actually making everybody else incredibly insecure at the same time. So we're fighting it from both sides.
Someone random.
Okay. Continuing the talk on credit cards. Me?
Good.
Okay. Continuing with the conversation on credit cards and stuff, I know this is just new to American. I don't know a whole lot about it, but we'd love to check technology on credit cards, since that'll apply to all of us. Can you guys explain why that's so much more secure than magnetic stripes on credit cards?
Because you don't just need the numbers to charge the card anymore, you need the chip. So a database full of credit card numbers without having that chip is going to be less valuable.
What does the chip produce that keeps it from seeing the actual number itself?
I am not an expert in that area. It has to do with cryptography.
I don't know the exact protocol stuff, but my understanding is that it's just the it's designed so that the credit card number is never transmitted to the vendor. So the credit card, Target or whoever, never gets your credit card number. The chip has a little crypto conversation with the point of sale and generates a unique code for that transaction. So all they get is a code that can get your $42.33. That's all it can get them. It can't get them anything else from that credit card. So what they're collecting is not useful, like I said, it's not useful to a hacker because it's already been used.
It doesn't strike me from the Amazon, but they can't do that.
Right.
The price for credit cards on like the black market is dropping, but medical records are staying pretty high. I have some friends that work at hospitals. They have machines that run like Windows XP because it's hooked up to an X-ray machine or something, and it has to be networked to get the X-rays to the doctor. But it's not even Windows XP Service Pack 2, it's Windows XP.
I'm just laughing because the crap I get within my company, if someone were to find a Windows XP machine that was actually still running, there would be hell
to pay. They can't upgrade it because the FDA, they have to go through a complete approval process, even just to apply a single update, let alone a service pack.
Yeah, and that circles back to the comment that I made earlier with just the level of bureaucracy. Security moves so quickly that if you're going to adequately secure your assets, you have to move quickly with it. And so long as you're hamstrung in situations like that, then it's kind of a losing game.
Well, what they should be doing in an environment like that is air gapping the network that those equipment is on. In other words, that the computer network that those systems are connected to shouldn't ever be connected anywhere that leads out to the internet. It should be completely separate. And that way, no one can get in. And that is used in a lot of businesses. Right up the street here at Turner, they air gap the networks that are used by the broadcast control people so that if you hacked into Turner, can't get to the systems that control what goes on the air.
Unfortunately, they have to get the records to like other offices to do
the right, but there are ways to handle that,
And so, we were talking about the OPM hack earlier, and you're talking about the Windows XP box now. A thing with that is, obviously, Windows XP went for last year, 2014. And, it's been out way too long, and people kept extending it, and I read an article few months ago or so that said that the U.S. government has in excess 170 million machines or actual computers deployed in government offices throughout the United States. Around 17% of those still run Windows XP. And obviously it's not
secure. So I work in the field and the government is my customer, so you can imagine when I bang my head against the wall all the time. And what I find out is it's more of a policy issue than a technology issue, right? So the policy problems that they have, mainly, besides the fact they don't know anything about computers, like you guys remember the DISA, Defense Information Systems Agency? This is probably the number one blocker of progress in the government in the history of the freaking government. But you'll find out that the policy issues keep things like Windows XP. The software company I work for makes Windows XP. And the government pays us extreme amounts of money to keep it in support. And Windows XP is a pile of crap. And you tell these guys, right, this GS14 or this SES1, sir, I work for the vendor that makes this operating system. It sucks. Upgrade. But we can't. Why? And they give you a whole bunch of reasons that don't even make any sense. It's just insane. The amount of, but it's mostly the policy problem. We can talk about technology and pass the hash and all this other stuff and everything you want to talk about. Secure domains that administer other domains and all that other stuff, but the real deal is policy. It's getting the changes done at the highest level. And that's the problem. Nobody knows what to do. Because you're talking to this guy who doesn't really have any control of the situation.
So I talk to general security and members of Congress all the time. And the problem is the members of Congress that are funding government to actually do security don't understand it whatsoever. And so in DC, cybersecurity means information sharing. Like, hands down. If you say cybersecurity to somebody, they're thinking, oh, information sharing, we're trying to pass laws to allow you to do that. And those laws are going to help this much of the cybersecurity problem that's this big, and they are going to do the things that would really help, like increasing funding, doing vulnerability disclosures, trying to encourage patching, all of the things that we're trying to get them to do. They don't understand that. And it's, again, because you're fighting both sides, it's not only not helping security, it's not getting you guys funded so you can, you know, replace the Windows XP systems, and instead you're funding old systems. It's different funding for updating systems versus getting installing new software. But then they're also trying to collect more user information, so they're fighting that side as well.
Yeah, but it's hubris too. These guys think that if they have a Windows 8 box or Windows 8.1 box that's running MaxP and the latest patches, they're good. Well, we're okay. We've got the skips and MaxP and the patches. We're okay. No, you're not, dude. You're not.
Yeah, And so it's not just politics and bureaucracy only in governmental organizations either. I mean, if you looked at a lot of these massive corporations that have gotten mobbed, how long have they been around? These aren't companies that just came about 10 years ago. If you look at the companies that have been established since the year 2000, generally speaking, they're going to have stronger security values than the ones that were established before. So in so many cases, you have these megacorps that are just monoliths, right? Like, being able to affect any sort of change in such a massive organization is quite difficult. So going from a business model that is just driven on functionality and features, and so everything is like, get this out, get it done, get it in the hands of our consumers, switching from, hey, wait a second, we actually need to slow that down, and we need to integrate security into this cycle, it's not going to happen overnight. And whether or not it's ever going to catch up to the speed of which the malicious actors are acting is up for debate.
I don't think you're ever going to have a system that's 100% secure and you'll always be up to date. But I think what someone last year on the panel said something that struck me was, don't be the low-hanging fruit. So y'all, try your best to update your systems to do what you can to keep your system secure. But ultimately, if it's the U.S. government or Iran or whoever, or the whatever actor there is who wants to break into your system, you're going to be able to do it some way.
Yeah. So there's always going to be the human element of someone who picks a bad password or leaves a default password on a system, or clicks on that stupid link in that email because they thought it was a real receipt and got scared. And that's all you need is to get that little foot in the door. In the case of clicking the link, typically it delivers malware of some kind to your computer. And then once you've gotten a piece of software onto that person's computer, all bets are off, because now you're inside the network. You're sitting at their desk with them, and you can leverage out from there. So even if we get everything patched and everything upgraded, there's always going to be that education element of trying to teach people to be secure and act secure and think about what they're doing when they're connected to the network.
How many people here use the same password for more than one account? Any two accounts?
Stop that.
There was a story last year that Dropbox had been hacked, and all of your Dropbox information was compromised. And the interesting thing was Dropbox absolutely had not been hacked. Some other database had been hacked. They got a lot of passwords, and they tested them against Dropbox, and they were able to use people's other passwords to access their Dropbox accounts and get in and get your information off of Dropbox. So the human element is absolutely crucial, educating people to not do password use on top of everything that was just said, because that's a really easy thing, and I imagine 90% to 100% of people do.
That reminds me, another thing is about cloud computing. So I'm not a techie by background, but basically I understand cloud computing to be, you give all your data to somebody else you don't know, and they store it on their servers in the cloud, so when you go to a different device, you can access it. Well, I mean, the hack of the celebrities in their new photographs, they uploaded it to the iCloud server, so that's kind of a bonehead move there to do that, but I think it just highlights, when you give your data to somebody else, you're relying entirely on their security and their system, and you better have faith that they know what they're doing, so I trust Microsoft.
That's why we have SLA.
And that's the thing about the cloud too, is probably all heard it, you know, it is, the cloud is just another computer somewhere else. And a stark fact is that no one will ever care for your data like you care for your data. So if you put something in the cloud, you're trusting someone else to take care of it the way you will, but no one ever will. It's always best to keep it to yourself.
And in response to the SLAs, yeah, so there's SLAs, great. Now we have a legal option to fall back upon when all the data gets out, but that doesn't fix the problem of data breaches. The data is still out there. The company itself now has an avenue to be reimbursed or to say, look, we took care of things because of X, Y, and Z, and to shift blame. It doesn't address the problem.
Fair.
And one in case this isn't demoralizing enough, Tim being on the defensive side now, it's so much more difficult than being on the offensive side. On the defensive side, your responsibility is to find every single hole. That's your ideal situation, is that you found all the holes, you patched them all, everything. I'll tell you right now, you give us access to one of the Windows machines on your internal domain, I will get everything on your network. You only have to lose one box.
Physical access to most support, yes, but not trying to get that out of our network.
That's definitely.
Yeah, it's true. It's true, and it, you know, it keep you up at night because we have, you know, we run a cloud service for businesses to do certain types of marketing stuff, and it's hundreds of computers in a data center, and every one of those computers has patches on it, it has software levels on it, and there's main ones that the people use all the time, but then there's these subsidiary computers that we use for maintenance purposes and things like that, and all you have to do is forget to put a patch on one of those little weird computers. And there are people out there looking all the time. Every time we, you know, fire up our management systems, look at what's going on the network. And every time I've ever fired up a packet sniffer on a public network and look, you barely ever have to look more than, you know, a minute or two before you see somebody probing. There's people out there constantly probing and looking for things to get into. And it's hard, and that's part of the reason, one of the things I wanted to mention about, and I was part of this problem in a former life when I built security tools, is people who are aware of the problem will buy security tools, they'll buy things called intrusion detection systems, and things like that, but the problem is these systems can be incredibly noisy, and they will learn to ignore them. They'll essentially, you know, buy this, you know, multi-hundred-thousand-dollar intrusion detection system, and then they'll realize the thing is lighting up every 5 minutes, and say, you know, turn that thing down. It's not helping us. And that actually happened in the Target breach. It came out in the Target breach that they had a device called a FireEye, which we have one of. It's a very impressive device that basically takes those attachments in your email or things that people click on the web, and it puts it into a little virtual computer inside the data center and clicks on it and watches what happens. And if something terrible happens, it sends an email to me. So essentially, it looks at all the attachments coming into your company. And Target got an alert from their FireEye that told them about the very malware that was ending up on their point-of-sale terminals. But they ignored it because they were getting too many alerts. And so that's the kind of thing on the defense side that can drive you crazy, because there's all sorts of stuff that's happening all the time, and a lot of it you can safely ignore. It's like, oh, well, that's a guy running a scanner. We know we're patched against the things he's scanning for. But, you know, all you have to do is miss one of them, and the guy is in.
Got a question over here. And then, yeah.
I'll say it's not just the policies, it's also how to fight up against the companies that are first running the sites. I spent 3 weeks fighting with a group within the government for one user that was running the site. We were patching to the newest version of Java. And he couldn't run the site because they refused to upgrade their Java compatibility beyond Java 1.71. Yeah. And I explained to them, I said, you know, me and the IA's, the information assurance team, this is a vulnerability, this is a region. They're like, we don't see a problem, we're just completely taken. And it literally, I ended up having to almost go up the food chain within my department and fight in order to get him to actually be able to run the system, because every time I got to where he could at least do his job, I had one user in my entire organization that needed to use the site. He would automatically get our update, the 1.85, re-pushed down, because that's the way our policy was. It's connected. It's like, we check for more, check for any outdated, automatically patch. So.
And I think that raises a good, good issue, is that a lot of times in the corporate industry or wherever, you'll have a techie trying to explain something to someone who doesn't have a technical background. So there's a learning curve involved. So you really have to incorporate that into the company.
I think somebody famous once said, if we can't protect the world, we damn well sure we'll avenge it. I don't mean to be pessimistic, but I'm not sure that's us. So after one of these big hacks, say Target's hacked, they're victimized, but what is the broader web on causes of action, liability? What do the indirect victims, like all of us, what rights do we have? And if not much, if all you try a simple negligence action, it's not going to go anywhere, what's in the works in terms of giving redress to the indirect victims of hacking?
So there are the class actions. These are starting, we're actually starting to see them being more successful. The class action against Sony was just upheld through the motion to dismiss stage, and if a class action can survive motion to dismiss, you're pretty good. So that is an option. The other option is the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission. There was actually an amazing case that came down last week or the week before, where the FTC had brought a fine against Wyndham Hotels, because Wyndham had not been properly securing customer data. And Wyndham challenged the FTC action, and the FTC won. It has still won at this stage, thanks to this court case. And so the FTC can now bring fines against companies who are not adequately protecting data. And anybody can file a complaint with the FTC. It's on the website, it's very easy. That doesn't mean they're necessarily gonna follow up with every single person's complaint, but that is an option as well. And then we're fighting for more protection from Congress. Right now there's a webworm of data breach notification laws. Every state has a different standard, every state has a different law, and we're fighting to get a federal standard that will actually be strong enough, but every time we fight for a federal standard, they want federal preemption. To explain that in layman's terms, it means the federal standard will surpass, it will render all 50 state laws invalid. So if your state has a stronger law than what the federal government passes, you will no longer have the same amount of protection, will be weaker protection. So we're trying to fight for a federal standard that sets a floor for how much protection you have, but not a ceiling. It allows you to have more. But another survey of the room, if you would rather have your credit card number or the photos on your phone compromised, like which one do you find more sensitive and which one would you rather protect? Is it your credit card number or all the photos on your phone?
Y'all are dirty on those.
Call my credit card company and get a new number.
So the problem is that most of the notification laws for if you've been in a breach are tied to financial harm. They're not tied to all of the other types of harm that you could face from being attacked. So that is the other thing that we're trying to find a way to measure non-financial harm. So if your non-financial data gets hacked, that there's also some notification requirement. And that will help feed into the FTC, feed into the lawsuits, because then you'll know that you have been breached.
I don't know policies that well, but you know, to answer what you said, you know, there's not much you can do, you know, unless, I guess, other than what maybe it might give you, you know, credit protection for a year or so. But you can deny them your business. You can spread word to other people. You can go back against them that way. If they're not going to be proactive, make sure that the business you give them is appreciated, then you should give it back to them. So you always have that power. You may not care, but you still have that.
From a technical standpoint, where would you say the majority of these exploits actually occur? Would that be like in the network transmission from the computer to the server, the actual operating systems themselves.
Web applications.
Web applications. The web applications.
That's the big thing.
Yeah, you should. It is difficult to write software securely, especially if you're writing in a language like PHP. And the thing is, web applications, so, you know, if you know about ports and IP addresses and stuff like that, you know that there's different services that run on different ports. Well, specific services are used for specific things. FTP is used for transferring files. SSH is used for, you know, issuing commands, stuff like that. But web services, they're everything else and then some. And they're everywhere. Everybody has one. Most people, well, not most, a lot of organizations have them on their internal networks and they're internet facing. So they present, generally speaking, the largest attack surface to people that are trying to build it.
And, you know, when it comes to that, if somebody can get into your network, if they're actively probing you, trying to get in somewhere, and you get to a point where they have an actual web application hosted, and you can get into that part of the network, and you can drop a drive, a flash drive in somewhere, and it can deploy as code. And like Chris said, if they're running FTP, I don't know how many everyone is. Who knows everything? Is FTP encrypted or unencrypted? So it's unencrypted. So if you can get into that and get that password going across, and you get unfettered access to maybe where the website's hosted at that point, if you can get in there, upload new files, the website looks the same, but then it could be distributing malware and you not know it. So it's, you know, that, I guess that's kind of something you have to watch out for, to be proactive on that side of the attack.
Yeah, I'd echo that as far as like looking for products that are out there, moving your money to that company. I mean, just because of the recent disclosures about the surveillance and tech and all that, it's been coming out in the last couple of years. You have companies creating encrypted phones now. There's still, I believe, PGP is believed to be fairly reliable. I'm not a techie, but
yes.
Yeah, so we have dissidents in other countries using it, so that seems like good enough for me. as an attorney, I have to, you know, be careful about that as well, because you have attorney-client privileged information. So that's just a risk on an individual and professional level as well. But I mean, there's stuff out there where, you know, it's kind of new and up and coming, and it's not foolproof yet. That, you know, Black Phone, I believe, is one that's coming.
Black phone is written, but if anybody has Silent Circle on their phones, which is secure texting through Silent Circle, Black phone is a co-product of theirs, and it's an entirely encrypted device that you can carry around with you in place of the phone that you have.
Thanks. So far, this whole talk has been about external intrusion and social engineering stuff. But we really haven't addressed at all the major problem with every Fortune 400 company I've ever worked for, including one now, and including one of the major data breaches I've worked for before. The systems are garbage. Since the Bush administration, all the IT people laid off, so much outsourcing, offshoring, everything else. Hardware today that the major banks and stock trading companies are running on is Clinton-era stuff that largely wasn't even configured properly to begin with, and now is a total mess. Everything is a mess from the SAN fabric, the network, the servers. It's all just garbage. And as far as I know, there are no standards for keeping companies responsible to set up systems and keep them going. I've never ever heard of an inspection of any kind or any organization that would even inspect something to make sure that a cluster is properly configured and can actually work. Like in the case of the Global Payments breach, less than a year before the Global Payments breach happened, I marched out the door in utter disgust from the company because it was so bad. Their production level Oracle code was so bad that it corked every 5 minutes. And their solution to this was not to fix their Oracle code, but to get us to queue up cron files and clear out core files periodically before they kill the file system and slam the database. The place was cabled so bad, their data center, none of the cages would actually close in any of the systems. And then for the data breach, that was an inside job. So much is offshore and whatever. A lot of stuff is offshore to Eastern Bloc countries, so there were Russian hackers in there. And none of this was ever revealed in the news. None of it at all.
Well, more specifically, what if you could phrase your question in like one sentence, what would you ask?
To make the companies responsible. What effort is there at all, or if anything, or any law that say
a Fortune 400 company
needs to store your banking information on systems that work?
Look at the scale of the security industry, and look at the continued growth of the security industry. I mean, there's very strong evidence, in fact, that people are taking this more seriously. You look at the results of the Target breach, and you see that C-level executives are potentially being held responsible for the data that was released. They might be personally financially responsible.
Yeah,
We've had that request come in. The way our business works, we actually sign a contract with each customer and we sell to other businesses. And the businesses send us sometimes ridiculously detailed security questionnaires about how we do our security. And one customer in Italy, I think, wanted us to put an executive on the form. We want a particular person to sign and say, they are responsible. It's like, what? So you can come and put handcuffs on them when something bad happens? But, it was an education thing there. But a lot of these companies are starting to get very aware, and they will quiz you. They will come and do on-site inspections.
That's something I haven't experienced at all. Not for utility companies.
It depends on what business you're in and how you do your customer contracts. It happens that we do a contract with each customer, so there's a whole process for this to happen. So that people do ask us very probing questions, and so we have to have good answers to give to them.
Well, so far I've never ever seen anybody actually, even Visa. I've done the testing for Visa to get the certification.
This goes back to...
Well, that goes
back to exactly what we said before with the fact that this is underfunded, overtaxed, and just not prioritized as much.
Yeah, so it's not prioritized at all.
But in a general trend that I have definitely observed, and hopefully you guys have seen as well, is that it is receiving additional attention.
Yeah. Because of all these big news stories, people are starting to stay up at night and wonder, is my company going to be next on this list? And I'll tell you, the company I worked for that just got bought by a gigantic company was a small company with a few hundred people here in Atlanta. And before I worked there, they had a data breach. And it was a come-to-Jesus moment, or however you want to put it, in terms of they were concerned that that company might cease to exist if they didn't deal with that data breach correctly. So they took it very, very seriously. And literally probably spent several $1 million over the next year or two buying technology, hiring people, changing procedures, changing code to make sure that never happened again.
I work for a very large company.
I think
now,
we have a couple more questions.
Banks. Not bank branches, but banks, the entire everything. And there's not a cluster in their entire network that can fail over without intervention.
We'll take
all their systems
out of the trash.
A couple more.
My question is, just ask the question, what do you suggest for us regular consumers, as far as how, just a private, just a regular individual, what is the best way to protect our data and our information? The chip-lock password is obviously the big one, but what else can we do? For those of us who, have credit cards on file on Amazon that go to Starbucks and use the internet, what can we do in your opinion?
One of the things that I do, and I'm just, again, a layman as far as this goes, is there's HTTPS. Instead of just straight HTTP, there are programs or browser plugins that will, that'll improve your security. It's a more secure protocol for accessing websites. So certain websites will have HTTPS. And if you get out there, like the Electronic Frontier, actually has a lot of good resources on how to make internet browsing safe. Like, make sure things are encrypted. And nothing's foolproof, but there's a lot of little things you can download just as free that will help.
first thing that you should do, everybody should do, is do a threat profile on yourself. Who are you trying to protect yourself from? Because you can't protect yourself from every single actor at every single time. If the NSA is after your data, you're up against a huge adversary. But luckily, most of you don't have the NSA after your data. You have a lot of criminals after your data. So first of all, decide who you're protecting yourself from. And then if you want to, the Electronic Frontier Foundation has a great thing called Surveillance Self-Defense. They're one of our partner organizations. We actually both have tables on this floor about 200 feet away. And you can go get information on surveillance self-defense and some of the tools that you can download and use. Things like a VPN, a virtual private network, secure text messaging. There are free apps where you can do secure text messaging. PGP email, which is actually very, not incredibly easy or usable, but when you have to communicate securely over email, it's a good go-to to do that. There are also free PGP tools that are trying to be set up to make PGP email very easy. Google is trying to do end-to-end encrypted email now. Like, seriously? That's against Google's business model. And they're trying to implement something that will keep you secure. So there are tools out there to try to help all of you guys.
One of the things, one of the threat models that affects all of us is credit card numbers, right? So one of the things I recommend is, you know, obviously we can't avoid some of these biggest, big, giant vendors wanting our credit card number or having a credit card number because we're doing a transaction. But what you can do is kind of avoid, if you do business with smaller vendors online, I mean, somebody like, you know, I hesitate to say this in this panel because we've been talking about Target and Sony and big companies, but you like to think that somebody like Amazon has their crap together and is not going to get completely owned. But if you're at, you know, mypurplesocks.com, which sells one kind of weird purple sock, maybe that guy doesn't have his security ducks in. So maybe you don't want to give him your credit card number. So look for something like the PayPal pay option, where you give your credit card number to PayPal, who maybe has their crap together, and all he gets is a payment from PayPal. Or Amazon Payments is another way to do that. Another simple option is, you know, don't check that box that says save my credit card number for the next time I come in here. So hopefully they'll throw it away after they run your transactions.
And, you know, to go a little bit, get like a further scope on things, who here connects to public Wi-Fi?
Right. Yeah.
So that's one of the biggest things there. There is a very cheap and easy to use device called a Wi-Fi timeout. And I can literally, I can run a little small command line program, and I can see what Wi-Fi networks your phone is trying to connect to, then rename a Wi-Fi network to that, and you'll connect straight to it. Your phone won't even ask. It will connect straight to it. And at that point, as long as I pass you onto the internet, I can see everything that you're doing in between there. There's even the option to strip out encryption and force you to go over non-encrypted channels. And
sounds like grounds for a lawsuit.
So I would just have two pieces to add to what everybody said so far. Manage your own expectations. I would be surprised if there's a single person sitting in this room who at least one of your credit card numbers is not currently in the possession of a malicious third party. That's just the way it is. And the only reason they haven't charged you yet is because they're sitting on millions and millions and millions of them. Your stuff is stolen. So act accordingly. Choose which cards you use where. Certain cards will give you additional security and additional insurance based on the transactions that you use them for. So you can take that into account. And then the second thing I would say, for the slightly more technical audience, virtualization. Zero days, exploits, cross-site scripting, man-in-the-middle attacks, all that stuff, you're not going to be able to get around it. We are security professionals. We don't even always get around it. Virtualization, you can basically have a second machine inside of your machine, and the ability to jump between those two is quite different. So do all the shady stuff you're gonna do on your computer, in your virtual machine, and keep all of your sensitive information in your host operating system where you're not really doing much of anything that will put you at risk.
I think you have a question?
I'm wondering what kind of a legal
blowback
do you see from the new PMB clause go into effect? Because from what I understand, that they're changing the financial responsibility of fraudulent transactions and putting them back on the consumer, versus to where the banks were paying them before, they're putting them back on the vendor.
What kind of law is it?
Have the new EMV laws for the credit cards, for the requiring the chips or the chip authentication if you're doing online? It basically, if you swipe the credit card instead of using the chip to read it, if the transaction gets disputed, the banks are no longer holding responsibility for that. They're leaving that responsibility on the vendors.
So I can't speak, I know a similar situation exists in Europe, and that's actually one of the reasons that Europe adopted the chip and PIN system before we did, was because basically the individuals were being held responsible for proving the transactions were fraudulent, which is not easy to do. Hence, they push for chip and PIN, and lo and behold, it gets implemented first. But that's quite interesting. I did not know that that was a thing, and that actually explains why chip and PIN is rolling out so quickly.
And this actually also, I've taken a note to look into this, so I'll take it back to my team. But this goes back to what was said before, which is know who you're doing business with. Some banks, even if the law says that you don't have liability, will go to bat for you if you have been the victim of fraudulent activity, which I have recently personally learned. And so do some research, trust the companies you're doing business with, and if you don't trust a company, maybe don't do business with them.
So, the panel touched on it briefly before, but one of the things that you said is a problem is the defender's dilemma. Is that as a company, you have to defend all the time, and the defender gets everything, and the attacker only has to find one initial problem. And a lot of the security industry I see is looking at it from a reactive point of view, so pen testing, great, but your hands are tied because pretty much every pen test I've seen is kind of and has even things that are out of scope. And tools that do scanning and things like that, you have a Turing halting problem and a program to validate the correctness of another program just doesn't work. So I'd like to ask the panel, what do you think are the things that in the future, just one thing you think will raise the bar, even only just a tiny bit, versus where we are right now?
Encryption and furthering the standards for encryption would be my recommendation. I'm not a techie, but that's what I was seeing, like the NSA disclosures that certain agencies were trying to actually undermine encryption. So I think that having a public recognition of the importance of it just in general would be a step forward. Because right now it's sort of like the exclusive province of the government. They're the ones that are getting to decide the issue of encryption, but really everybody's mainstream, right? The mainstream needs to understand that encryption is important and how to implement it.
Metadata obfuscation. Most of the social engineering comes because they learn something about you, and then they can take that thing and get more information about you. And it's amazing how much data about you is in your metadata. And even encryption, it's very hard to protect that. Location information, who you're calling, who your contacts are, trying to find a way to start to obfuscate that a little bit better than we're doing now.
So I think my penetration testing friends on my left here might be able to back me up where encryption is very strong. Absolutely. If you want to protect something, encrypt it. 9 times out of 10, the encryption key is sitting right next to the encrypted data, which basically nullifies the encryption. As far as addressing data breaches at scale, I don't know. I think Tim is probably by far the expert here, but there's really not a silver bullet. There's
not a silver bullet, but this chip and PIN thing that we've mentioned several times, the new chips that are on your credit cards, when that is fully rolled out in the United States and everybody's supporting it in their end-user terminals and we're using it everywhere, that's going to help. That's going to help a lot because it's going to reduce these troves of credit card numbers that are sitting in databases.
So, Mark, is the difference between proactive defense versus reactive defense?
Yeah.
What is proactive defense? How do you defend against what you don't know about?
Proactive, I mean going after them and arresting them?
No, instead of responding to a threat, basically blocking them before they even have the idea, more or less.
The threats first.
Well, essentially, you saw a customer where they also got CSA, where you ran a profile on a machine, and then only things that you whitelist as taken.
All of these systems have bypasses, and I've seen them all. I've dealt with a lot of them. I am not a big fan of appliances. I do not work for the company or the product that I'm about to endorse, but as an attacker that has been in a number of environments, the single device that has out of the box given me the most trouble to the point that I was almost ripping my hair out was a 4Scout. It's not 4Scout Edge, it's 4Scout. It's a device that works on an internal network. It's a full stack intrusion prevention system, but one of the things that it does is that it can detect when you're scanning. So Nmap scans have some pretty unique fingerprints that you'll see, and first it'll tarp at you. So it'll actually hold on, you'll send your SYN out, and it'll hold on to the SYN and act for a few seconds and then let it back, and your crawling speed or your scanning speed crawls to a trickle. And then they also smooth open ports. So once you get your information back, you can't even tell. Yeah, you can't even tell what's legitimately open. And what that does is, as the defender, any time where you can stymie the attacker and keep them mucking around in your systems generating forensic data, that's a win. And I can't endorse anything other than that.
One more quick question. We're out of time here.
So, I have really two questions. First off, how long, generally, on these hacks that we talked about, were they in the system before detection actually realized that something was going on? And second of all, since a lot of times people are, those credit cards, you know, I get a new credit card number, I'm no longer exposed, do you see that the public is like, well, everybody's been hacked, so it's not a big deal because I get a new credit card?
Well, apparently it's about to be our problem with that new legislation, so we'll probably see some sentiment shift in that department.
Yeah, but there is a pain threshold with online stores because of the state of my credit card. I know, for instance, I have a credit card that I use to pay a lot of bills automatically online, and if I had to change the number on that card, I got to jump through a bunch of hoops in the next few days to change it on like 14 different websites. So hopefully that pain level will help people realize that they need to protect.
How long were the hacks active before they
were active? Anthem was active for over 2 years, I believe.
Yeah. I think their estimates are at least 2 years.
Yeah, and just know that these numbers that are being told to the public, whether or not they reflect the truth at all, I mean, these are the same people that couldn't detect the problem for however long it was there, and then them being able to go back and deterministically say, oh, well, they were only here for a few months. Sorry, you probably don't have the technical capacity to say that.
On that note.
Thank you all for coming.